Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Peter B. is grateful to the individuals who subscribe to this podcast and support my work, including Jeffrey Lipinski, Grant Gibson, Annette McManus, and Sean Smith. If you're not a subscriber, hey, come on, get on board. Just follow the links under my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear the second installment in our two-part podcast series about the NSA-4. And brace yourselves, Thomas Drake here has a very powerful indictment. Not only of the corruption that he witnessed at the NSA, but the failure to prevent the attacks of 9/11, and the creeping police state in this country, and he's not afraid to use the F word, fascism. This is a powerful interview, and I encourage you to share it with friends and family. Everybody needs to know that our Bill of Rights has been under assault since 9/11. And that the Obama administration has dangerously extended many of the precedents that occurred under Bush and Cheney. Here you go. We continue this special podcast regarding the NSA-4. High-ranking officials who worked at the National Security Agency and blew the whistle and paid dearly for it. The first-person account of Bill Binney, who worked at the NSA for over 30 years, and journalist Tim Shorrock. And joining me now is Thomas Drake, who also worked at the NSA and blew the whistle on the issues related to Thin Thread and Trailblazer, perhaps among other issues. And he paid quite a price. In 2010, he was indicted on a total of 10 counts, including 5, under the Draconian Espionage Act. Tom Drake, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
And thanks for your service to the country, and thank you for what you've been through to try to stand up for the law and for honest delivery of government services. You've had quite an ordeal, haven't you?
That's a bit of an understatement, to say the least.
Yeah. So, if you could, can you tell us what the retaliation has cost you? I know that fundamentally, when you took a guilty plea to a very minor charge, that it cemented the loss of your security clearance, and that makes it impossible for you to work in the field that you have devoted your life to.
Well, it's fair to say that my life was turned upside down as a result of the ordeal that I experienced at the hands of the government, and it certainly, at the point I was raided, and then particularly 2.5 years later when I was actually indicted on 10 felony counts, 5 under the Espionage Act, life was never going to be the same again.
And you now have a job at an Apple store. My friend Mel Goodman, a former CIA officer, told me in January that he had encountered you there. And certainly, you know, you have technical skills that you can put to use there, but it's fair to say you're extremely underemployed for your skills and your work history.
That's probably true, but it certainly was one of many prices I paid for standing up and speaking truth to power.
Mm-hmm. And can you put an estimate on what your legal fees set you back?
Well, it was close to $100,000 in terms of just the fees to a private attorney. But there are many, many other expenses with respect to loss of income. I had to take a second mortgage out of my home. I had to essentially empty well over half of my accrued retirement account. And so, you know, all of those expenses and then simply the inability to pursue a livelihood after having been declared persona non grata, you know, blackballed and blacklisted, it's approaching $1 million.
Mm-hmm. And, Tom, I have talked with many different people who are called whistleblowers from a whole range of agencies, FBI, CIA, DEA, NSA. And to a person, they never expected to wear that label. They consider themselves to be honorable employees who were living up to the commitment they had made as part of their job and their security clearances to expose any wrongdoing that they observed in their line of work. So is this epithet of whistleblower uncomfortable for you?
I wouldn't say uncomfortable. It certainly has become those who blow the whistle in today's age, it's particularly dangerous to do so. It's, at least under the Obama administration, it's become a criminal act for standing up and speaking truth about government conduct, wrongdoing, up to and including illegality. Never mind massive fraud, waste, and abuse, or threats to public safety or health. I mean, my eyes were wide open in terms of what you would call my whistleblower activities. But you don't wake up in the morning and say, "Hey, I'm going to become a whistleblower today."
Mm-hmm.
That's just not how it goes. In my particular case, I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution. I took an oath to defend an idea that was, you know, launched over 220 years ago. It wasn't an oath to the president. It wasn't an oath to the NSA. It wasn't an oath to my boss. And it certainly wasn't an oath to using secrecy and classification to cover up government wrongdoing and even criminality.
And, Tom, I'm glad you mentioned that because when the president was sworn in for his second term this past January, I raised the question with a number of people just in the simple, narrow definition of the statement that he makes in the oath of office to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And as you pointed out, that oath that government employees and elected officials take, and it's, you know, the language can be slightly varied, but it is about honoring the Constitution. It's not even about protecting innocent people from terrorism or defending our shores or anything broader than that. It is narrow and explicit. And in my view, President Obama has failed to live up to that oath of office. What is your view?
Well, there is that special clause in the Constitution. The President of the United States does take a special oath. The oath that I took four times in my government career is a version of that. In fact, all government civilian employees as well as military take an equivalent oath. The President is under special obligation to preserve, protect, and defend. And it is clear to me that the Constitution is simply become piece of paper in which you genuflect at least the veneer of that oath, but in reality, behind the scenes, you're doing everything you can to unchain yourself, unbind yourself from the very Constitution that you're constitutionally obligated to protect, support, mm-hmm. and defend. And I just find it extraordinarily hypocritical. I mean, I certainly watched the second, as he entered into his second administration and took that special oath for the last time. And I just find it sad. It's sad for the country. It's sad for history. And it just speaks very powerfully to some of the concerns that for all the faults and flaws of the Founding Fathers, they were quite concerned about executive power and executive power unconstrained by the limits imposed by the Constitution. We do forget too easily that it's only the enumerated powers that are declared in the Constitution. And unfortunately, post 9/11, we've seen an extraordinarily rapid erosion of those fundamental rights in the name of national security. And national security, in so many respects, has unfortunately become the prime directive that all falls under it, and all will fall in line to it, and all will take a oath of fealty to national security. As I've said in other fora, national security, which is an overloaded word phrase in itself, has become the new state religion.
And Tom, in particular, you were a front row witness to the deconstruction of the Fourth Amendment, because prior to 9/11, you were working in the security arena, and the legacy was from the Cold War. And the mandate of the NSA was to monitor communications outside the United States. But after 9/11, under the direction of Michael Hayden, who, despite the failures that we'll discuss in a moment, was later promoted to CIA director and then director of national intelligence, now has a cushy job as a consultant with the Chertoff Group, he didn't seem to be very interested in the constitutional issues. And that was one of the central factors, the two drivers of the dispute over the thin thread software that was developed by Bill Binney and others at the NSA, and the Trailblazer software, which was being peddled by outside contractors, in addition to the huge cost disparity, $3 to $4 million for thin thread, as much as $8 billion for the failed Trailblazer program. The other major distinction was that thin thread made allowances to protect the Fourth Amendment rights of Americans in the United States, and specifically Trailblazer did not. Now, as you've pointed out, Trailblazer was never successfully deployed, and so the effort to roll over our Fourth Amendment rights in that respect was unsuccessful. But the intention that Hayden and Bill Black in particular had, the highest-ranking officials at the NSA, they weren't concerned about maintaining constitutional barriers.
No, they weren't. 9/11 was a triggering event, and as I was told, you need to understand, Tom, we are now under exigent conditions, and exigent conditions, another word for extraordinary, meant that we would have to meet it with extraordinary means, and if that means in secret violating the Constitution, so be it. If you've done nothing wrong, what's going to be a little erosion of your constitutional rights? That's what I was told. You have to remember, Trailblazer in some ways was the boondoggle of a bright, shiny object. Many, many, many billions were spent on that program. They doubled down after 9/11. The decisions that were made after 9/11, though, actually the more significant ones, is they rejected the in-house solution that had been developed over a period of several years, which not only provided superior intelligence, but fundamentally protected the Fourth Amendment rights of Americans, and in particular, absolutely adhered to the exclusive means by which you would conduct electronic surveillance against U.S. persons. That's anywhere in the world, by the way, not just domestic. And U.S. persons defined as U.S. citizens, resident legal aliens, or U.S. corporations. That was all abandoned shortly after 9/11. That legal regime, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which had been born out of the massive abuses by the U.S. government secret against, this is even before we had FISA, but during the 60s and 70s, where the U.S. used its own instruments of power against dissenters, journalists, war protesters, and quote-unquote enemies of the state. 9/11, you just dispensed all that. I mean, there was criminal sanctions if you violated that statute, which was passed under the Carter administration in 1978. Mm-hmm. That legal regime of 21 years was simply tossed overboard. I haven't said this recently, but not only was the United States government in a new, in the wheels had come off the vehicle, we were in an entirely new vehicle, a vehicle that I did not recognize. Mm-hmm. And I was eyewitness, ringside seat, you know, right there on the playing field, as it were, observing and seeing the subversion of our own Constitution.
And Tom, the other real troubling aspect of this is the profiteering against the backdrop of this new paradigm. And Bill Binney told us, our listeners heard this a few minutes ago, that the race for profit from the contractors led by SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, and at the trough was also Booz Allen Hamilton, Lockheed Martin, TRW, Northrop Grumman bought TRW. And what he said was that this race for profits trumped the mission of the agency. And as he describes it, there was a period of time before and shortly after 9/11 when, because of the political infighting, that Thin Thread was not activated or perhaps not fully operational. And so we had extreme vulnerabilities at that very critical time.
Yes. I live with the burden. I live with the certainty of what could have been in terms of history. I was charged after 9/11 at the highest levels of NSA. My boss at the time was the Signals Intelligence Directorate, director of the Signals Intelligence Directorate, was charged because of a tenet memo that went out to the entire intelligence establishment. Anything you've got in the labs, anything you've got that's a prototype, anything you're testing, put it into the fight because we need it. And so I went to the ends of NSA to find those programs, to find those efforts. One of them was Thin Thread, as well as a number of others. Unfortunately, 9/11 was perceived by much of management, and as was actually told to the workforce, a gift to NSA. It became a profit center, and many, many contractors simply saw it as a way to expand their ability to generate huge, huge amounts of revenue, and all the fear and the hysteria and the knee-jerk response generated massive amounts of check writing, very large numbers by Congress. In fact, so much money that NSA itself, in that year after 9/11, was having great difficulty just finding places to spend it fast enough. I still remember sitting in a meeting where they actually said that. They had this one chart where everything was green except for this one place where it said red, and the reason it was red is because they hadn't spent the money fast enough. I mean, we were just engorged on money. It was quite something, as if money was a solution. And here was this $3 million Thin Thread solution, the very best of American ingenuity and innovation, that just was ignored and dismissed. And even when Congress actually passed legislation, signed into law by Bush in early 2002, directing, mandating the NSA would deploy Thin Thread to the the most critical counterterrorism sites around the world. NSA defied the law, and it never was deployed.
Now, Tom, Bill Binney told us that he left the agency not too long after 9/11 in disgust and concerned that he was a party to egregious violations of the law and Constitution. You stayed for a lot longer. Tell me at what point you realized that Trailblazer was a hustle and that it was really an empty project that was enriching the contractors, but not producing the deliverables.
No, at the expense of national security. Essentially, they sold out.
Mm-hmm.
National security was sold out to the highest bidder, and the contractors just piled on. As I've said, the Trailblazer bar was open feeding frenzy. You belly up to the bar, and there was more than enough money to go around. For everybody, as one of the other senior executives said, hey, don't rock the boat. There was that much money. It was just staggering, the billions that were being spent. But the critical thing is, I knew this within just the first few weeks. And you have to remember, in my case, I stayed on till April of 2008 when I ultimately resigned after I was raided by the FBI in November of 2007. So, I remained for many, many years afterwards dealing with the system from within. There were two key things. You had the massive fraudulent waste of Trailblazer, which was just was a flagship program. There was many other programs related to Trailblazer, where Trailblazer was the umbrella. You also had the secret surveillance program. And it was on those two pillars that I became a whistleblower within the government.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, did you ever feel a temptation to use the revolving door? After all, Bill Black had worked for SAIC before he came back to NSA, and his number two guy, is it Visner? He worked for SAIC, Samuel Visner, and came back to run Trailblazer for the NSA's SIGINT division. Did they ever offer you the opportunity to go through that revolving door and make big bucks in the private sector?
Oh, yeah. I remember being approached when I was the senior executive at the time. I had left the Signals Intelligence Directorate. This was in late 2000 into... And I was approached by one of the very large contractors about coming to work for them at a very senior level, and that I could essentially quintuple my salary of, and that was before bonuses. And most people couldn't resist. Most people would hear the siren call of lots of dollars. I still remember a couple of years later when I was the NSA Corporate Advisory Board member to the International Council on System Engineering, and we were up at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. They have this evening event at the president's home looking out over southern Manhattan, you know, from the New Jersey side on the cliffs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the tart room, the dessert room, you know, that was laid out in heavy hors d'oeuvres, and I got to talk, and it turned out I was a very senior member of the Defense Science Board, the highest board that advises the Secretary of Defense. And he said, we got to chat and small chat, and said, "Don't stay beyond 5 years. The real money is when you get out. Believe me, the real money." I'm sitting here thinking, "Yeah, that's all he's thinking about." It's like this all of this. No, he wasn't talking about what was in the best interest of the national security. He was simply cashing in, and people cashed in big. So yeah, the temptations were there. It was put right in front of me. The oath for me was not to that. The oath was important from the Constitution, and you know, I had people even said I was naive, that you know, we lived in a different era and you don't understand, Tom. And in fact, the irony for me is when I actually joined NSA under a special program that was headed by General Hayden, because of severe pressures being placed on them by Congress, that you know, they really weren't meeting the demands of the 21st century internet age, I actually had I had officials at NSA saying, are you sure you want to give, because I was doing quite well in industry. I was consulting in Silicon Valley, doing lots of IT governance and working with many companies around the U.S. You know, it was the go-go years of internet, and there was a lot of cool things going on, and I gave all that up to come back into the government at a very senior level. And I was actually asked if I could survive on a senior executive salary.
Mm-hmm. And that's about $140,000 in the government?
Yes, in that range. Yeah. I think I was originally hired was about $133,000, and when I left, I was making about
$155,000. Mm-hmm. Wow. And so, Tom, when you look at the path that you have taken and the price that you've paid and the incredible retaliation that was visited on you, and then you look at General Hayden, who was promoted not once but twice, and now is presumably being very well paid in the private sector. How do you feel? Are you bitter toward Hayden?
No, I'm not bitter toward Hayden. Hayden is obviously a central character in my story. You know, he's probably one of the most politically astute generals that I ever knew in my government military career, and I was an officer at one point in the U.S. Navy. He's cashed in big time. You know, he's a principal of the Chertoff Group. All of the realities of 9/11, the national security state, the continuing promotion of faux fear and hysteria. He's riding the wave, and you know it's been very, very good to him. I'm not bitter, but it's certainly, I never imagined that the country would sell out at those levels. I mean, people don't recognize, fully appreciate how massive the redistribution of wealth has truly been, basically extracting from the very best of America. And just simply, and of course, was massive deficit spending to the tune of trillions of dollars. For what? You know, for what? I happen to, you know, people talk about, yeah, Tom, I was told at one point, you know, your program, because I was, when the guys left, when Bill and the others left, I became the executive program manager on ThinThread. I decided that I would do my best to continue the fight, even in spite of the odds. And I was told in a meeting that, you don't understand, Tom, your program was just too small in size. You need to be at least $10 million to even get noticed. Well, what chance did you stand in that kind of environment, $3 million program versus, at that time, a $4 billion-plus program? You didn't. And, in fact, Marie McGinsky, who I reported to, she was the number three person at NSA, you know, she said, who do I piss off? You know, a dozen people in a small project, or, you know, the Trailblazer crowd? Well, she didn't want to run crossways with Trailblazer.
I want to ask you about a specific incident related to interagency rivalries. Michael Scheuer, who was at the CIA running the Bin Laden desk, the ALEC operation, named after his son, he reported that at one point he was able to identify the location of a satellite phone that was used to communicate with Osama bin Laden. And it was traced, and Jim Bamford has written about this, it was traced to a safe house in Sana'a, Yemen. And so Scheuer made a request of the NSA, first for a full transcript of intercepts from that satellite phone. And then when he was rebuffed, he was able to get one link of it, either the uplink or the downlink, one side of the conversation. And he said, well, I took that to the NSA and said, well, look, I've already got half of it. Can you just cough up the other half? And he said that they turned him down. Number one, you know, are you able to confirm that? And number two, are there other significant cases of this kind of interagency squabbling that left us, you know, either undefended or just unable to pursue the clear missions assigned?
I'll answer it this way. I live with the dirty knowledge of what could have been, and what could have been is that 9/11 could have been prevented by virtue of what NSA alone knew, should have known, didn't share, or could have known. It's one of the deep, dark chapters in the post-9/11 and pre-9/11 history that is yet to be fully written. The extent to which NSA is culpable and also went into a major cover-up. One of the things that Hayden was quite proud of, and I remember in the executive session, is that he was more than willing to have the FBI and the CIA take the heat while NSA remained in the shadows, away from the prying eyes of the investigators. The NSA did all it could to obstruct the investigation, several investigations. For me, I had the certain knowledge. You spoke of one incident. There's any number of other incidents in terms of pre-9/11 intelligence that was either never shared with national command authorities, to say it that way, or those responsible for, in terms of receiving actual intelligence, indications or intelligence, and then doing something with it. NSA bureaucratically had this thing that only they owned it. Whatever they took, they owned, and they didn't trust anybody with, if they gave it to somebody, they didn't know what they would do with it. So they tended to hoard it, and hoarding meant that no one else could see it. So they're very reluctant to share critical intelligence. And I ended up not only as a whistleblower, but a material witness on two 9/11 congressional investigations in early 2002, and then the joint inquiry that involved both the Senate and the House, the prelude to the 9/11 Commission. I gave them prima facie evidence of what NSA had failed to share, including critical actual intelligence regarding Al-Qaeda and associated movements that could have easily rolled up that entire network. All of that was reported to the investigators, and I will tell you that all that information was censored. It was hidden behind state secrets. It was never made part of the final report. Now you tell me.
I appreciate the way you answered my question, and let me just push one more time. Is Scheuer's story accurate?
Yeah, it's fair to say that Scheuer's story is accurate. That's just one of any number of cases in which critical intelligence. There was an interesting meeting I remember with Hayden where the demands were quite strong for NSA to share raw intelligence because there was so much information coming in. I remember they didn't have the benefit of ThinThread. You know, what I didn't tell you is that we actually took ThinThread. We had a couple $1 million. I was able to wrestle out of Marine Baginski. They would not let ThinThread go on to the operational system, you know, out there to do real intelligence. So we said, okay, fine, let's take a look at the database, the main database at NSA. We found critical actual intelligence pre-9/11 and post-9/11 that had never been discovered at all. And they shut it down. That was the last that you ever heard of ThinThread.
So, Tom, this produces two different follow-up threads. Number one, about Michael Hayden. Given the political operator that you just described and the flat statement that he helped cover up or hoard information at NSA that should have been shared with others,
yeah.
Then he was promoted to the post, ultimately the DNI, Director of National Intelligence. And the whole idea that Congress had in creating that post was to end the silos and to create, an umbrella entity that would coordinate the all these different intelligence arms that we have, the dizzying array. Knowing what you know about Hayden, did he actually honestly do that job as the Director of National Intelligence, or did he maintain the the modus operandi that you saw at the NSA?
Well, he reported to Negroponte. He was the principal deputy director before he was promoted to the Director of CIA. He was highly incentivized to cover up his role. Hayden is a very interesting character in all this, and the full truth still needs to come out about him regarding his central role in not only obstructing the investigations that ensued after 9/11, but his active cover-up of what NSA actually knew, even even at the time, and did not share. He's a revisionist historian. He basically has claimed in reverse that if he had the technology of Stellar Wind prior to 9/11, he could have stopped it. He actually did have the technology called Thin Thread that would have not only provided the superior intelligence, but would have absolutely adhered to the Constitution. He chose to ignore that willfully and deliberately. And it's one of the sad chapters, truly sad and tragic chapters. And he continues to roll himself out as a spokesperson of that revisionist history. You have to remember that Hayden himself was a critical player in the decision that was made in deepest secrecy, a secret to which, to this day, we do not know the full nature. Shortly after 9/11, enter into a special arrangement with the White House where NSA would become the executive agent for the Constitution-busting, Fourth Amendment-violating secret surveillance, so in essence turning the United States into the equivalent of a foreign nation for electronic surveillance. We still don't know the full extent of that publicly. The memos, the John Yoo memo that's associated with that, has never been made public. We've had many other memos made public, but certainly not that one. And so in the deepest of secrecy, that program existed from 2001 to 2005. And then there was that blockbuster article, the New York Times article written by Eric Lichtblau and James Risen, revealing for the first time publicly the existence of the so-called warrantless wiretapping program.
Mm-hmm.
It's important for history. That's the reason I was ultimately tagged and targeted by the administration. Although, interestingly enough, I was never actually prosecuted under the Bush administration. It took the Obama administration to prosecute and indict me.
And Tom, what you just described has been cemented by the actions of the Obama administration and the Holder Justice Department, because we have a kind of perfect storm where what I view as obstruction of justice and the president calls looking forward, not backward, has led to not only no investigations of the wrongdoing that occurred in the era you just described, but has created the cover for it to continue to this day. And then you add the FISA so-called reform law of 2008, which immunized the phone companies, and the most recent Supreme Court decision that denied standing to individuals who thought they had been wiretapped. And so the doors have been slammed, and the seal is pretty tight on almost all of these secret matters.
Well, that is sadly true. The national security state is taking primacy over a constitutional form of government. And that legislation you mentioned, 2007, the telecom immunity, 2008, the FISA Amendments Act, which, of course, it had sunset clauses. They renewed all that without, any amendments.
Yeah.
This past year, as it was due to expire. Those are all enabling acts. They are enabling acts to legislate into law what had been, we're talking about ex post facto law, what had been illegal. And that in itself is used as a cover to further extend. You have CISPA right now, the Cyber mm-hmm. Intelligence Information Sharing Act, which is really an attempt to enable in secret what the government's doing under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which has been this secret executive interpretation that we have access to all subscriber information. CISPA, which got passed by the House, we'll see if it passes the Senate.
Well, did you hear that the Obama White House is threatening to veto it? They have acknowledged that it is too broad and invasive in terms of the personal privacy of Americans. I was shocked.
Yeah, well, that's a kabuki dance. They did the same thing with the National Defense Authorization Act and ultimately signed it into law anyway.
And defended it very aggressively. You're right. Yeah. Tom, the other thread I wanted to pursue, you talked about the various 9/11 investigations, the two congressional operations, and then the Hamilton-Cain Commission. And I went to Washington at my own expense and spent some time observing the work of that 9/11 commission. And I came away simply disgusted. I felt it was a whitewash. And I used the metaphor at the time of the ditch witch. And maybe you're familiar with this construction machinery. And you set it to dig a ditch of a certain width and depth. But it doesn't go beyond that. And I felt that the 9/11 Commission and its history of the resistance of the Bush White House, the underfunding, the initial naming of Henry Kissinger to run it, from beginning to end, it was a very tragic joke played on the survivors of the 9/11 attacks. Without asking you to agree or disagree with me, what's your own assessment of the work of the 9/11 Commission and its ultimate credibility?
Well, interestingly enough, to me, it was a very elaborated cover-up. I was never asked to participate in their investigation. I've had a number of people who thought I was by virtue of my previous status as a whistleblower and as a primary material witness. But that's not the case, and the 9/11 Commission did not pursue areas that it really needed to. It actually persisted the reality of what was truly causal in terms of 9/11, and there are those who have even admitted that they did not get a whole lot of cooperation from NSA during the course of their investigation. When you read the totality of what they published publicly, you don't see a whole lot in there about NSA. They're sort of mixed in with the other government agencies, and so there's this collective culpability, a failure of imagination, as they characterized it. The reality of it is that NSA was central to why 9/11 happened, central. And you had very senior officials, up to and including Hayden, who've done their best over the years to not only justify the response to 9/11, but also to ensure that their own culpability does not see the light of day.
Tom, one of the people who has helped me understand the dimensions of the interception of telecommunications is Mark Klein. Mark worked at AT&T in San Francisco. I've got his book in front of me. It's called Wiring Up the Big Brother Machine and Fighting It. He exposed the creation of a secret room at the Folsom Street switch that was controlled by the NSA, the arrival of equipment that he knew the purpose of, which was to divert all of the email and voice traffic, regardless of where it originated, to an unknown destination controlled by the NSA. Tell me what you think of Mark Klein and what his revelations have meant in terms of our understanding of this massive surveillance effort.
Well, I've met Mark Klein a couple of times, and he's absolutely real and completely authentic. He happened to stumble across something that I was well aware of in secret, where NSA, in the deepest of secrecy, special arrangements made with telecom companies like AT&T, would enter into these arrangements. And after 9/11, those were greatly expanded. And that was one of the primary locations. There was a system that AT&T had called Daytona that did blanket collection for other purposes, and one of those purposes involved the relationship with NSA. So, and that was just one of several arrangements that were made. This is all in secret. I mean, this is all being done under, it's way beyond the Constitution, way, way beyond. And the justification for it was the threat was so great that we needed to see everything. What I was told after 9/11 was you simply needed the data. It didn't matter where we got it from. We just needed it because we never knew we might need it again. And that was the justification. It's sad commentary. It's tragic commentary that the very best of American innovation and ingenuity was never had a chance in that kind of environment. And so, remember Frank Church. I was a very young teenager in the 70s, and I remember those extremely strong and dark words of Frank Church when he warned the nation in 1975, the Church Committee hearings, the extent to which at that time the government had been violating the law and the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, you know, what would happen in the future with more advanced technology, would be able to pull ourselves back across the Rubicon. Here I was, eyewitness. I knew we had opened up Pandora's box. I still remember the chilling conversation I had with one of the lead attorneys in the NSA's Office of General Counsel, because I was fighting from within. I was going to my boss, I'd gone to others, and I finally talked to this attorney, and he said, it's all legal. The White House has approved it. We're the executive agent for the program. They always called it the program. That was Stellar Wind. They just made the decision in secret that they were going to violate the Constitution, and it was in the best interest of the country. And I knew that was the first week in October. What I did not know at the time is that Bush had officially signed the secret directive authorizing NSA to become the executive agent. First week in October of 2001, and the Patriot Act is passed, and the NSA was already in violation of the Patriot Act when it was passed in late October of 2001. And that's where we are. I mean, historically, in times of crisis, this country has eroded liberty and rights for the sake of security. But there's always tended to swing back. Since 9/11, it just keeps swinging out. And under Obama, people just need to appreciate it's become even more expanded. I mean, I think again, fuller history will be written to the extent to which not only did Obama take hook, line, and sinker everything that Bush had in front of him in terms of the secrets regime, he's gone far beyond. I spoke to a former official, this is a couple years ago, from the Bush administration, who actually used the word woe, describing what Obama was doing. He said, we never could have gotten away with that. And yet here he is going far beyond even what we did.
Well, Hayden himself said that he was shocked when we used a drone strike to kill Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen.
Yeah.
He said, when I was there, we would have had to get a warrant just to listen into his phone.
Correct.
And so, yes, I certainly agree with your assessment there. Tom, can you shed any light on something that has troubled me for a long time?
Sure.
Quest was, I believe, one of the handful of phone companies that held out to the initial requests for data records and also for intercepts. And in particular, Quest was asked not for international circuits, but for local circuits that the government wanted to monitor. And Joseph Nakio was the CEO of Quest, and he was investigated, I believe, on an insider trading charge and sentenced to 6 years in federal prison. Was he set up?
I believe he was. I think, and this is well before 9/11. I believe he was for his not cooperating with, you know, special requests to turn over information, and he chose to stand up and say, "Wait a minute, you know, where's your authority? I don't see the warrants." And they just wanted him for the purpose of national security to just give it up, and he said, "No, I won't." And I believe they trumped it up in a way, painted it, framed him. I certainly can identify with that because that's precisely what they did with me in a different context, but a very similar approach.
Yeah.
But yes, and we have to remember that took place before 9/11.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you reminded me of that because I had misplaced it in my memory's timeline as occurring after.
The bottom line is the United States government has been operating in an other than a constitutional manner since 9/11. It's continuity of government. It's COG. And it is what takes priority is the national security state. Who cares about the Constitution? You got to remember, John Yoo himself referred to it. I mean, he was the legal apologist in the Office of Legal Counsel, basically coming up with excuses for the executive branch, and he said it was a quaint document. I mean, this is one of the things about our country, for all of our faults and foibles and contradictions, and there are many. It was an idea. I mean, James Madison imagined the Constitution in those winter months of 1786, the abysmal failure of the Articles of Confederation. And so the Grand Experiment was launched in 1787 and, you know, ratified, well, if you say 1789 with the ratification of the original 13 colonies. And, of course, then we had the Bill of Rights, right, because there was so much concern about, well, it wasn't enumerated in the Constitution. We needed the first 10 amendments to ensure that those were enshrined. We just too easily forget our own history. But it was just an idea. It was an idea. It was a grand experiment. And I have, as I've said, you know, I fear for the future of the Republic. If my case is any example, as well as others, this is how far the government will go to destroy you if you simply decide that the Constitution takes primacy over everything else in terms of our form of governance. Obviously, if you're for the national security state, then you'll be looking for any reason, justification, to unchain yourself, to allow you unfettered conduct in secret as you will. And that type of power does not yield willingly. And I'm afraid most people don't realize the extent of what we've lost. I mean, I just want to get back to a 9-10, let alone what happened after 9-11.
Yeah, the old normal.
The old normal. And yet the new normal, as Hayden himself said, in reference to the tragedy of Boston, right, the new normal. Well, what? The new normal is just even more cameras and even more surveillance? What? I mean, this is a psychosis. This is an extraordinarily deep insecurity, and we keep dealing with it by simply wheeling out more liberty eroding and you know, rights disappearing measures. You know, I had an interesting conversation. I was in Europe recently, and it was a very interesting conversation. Someone who lived in Germany says, "Well, at least we know we live in a post-fascist society. You're in a pre-fascist society." We don't use that word very often, but you have an extraordinary alliance between government and corporations, and they don't want to give that up. I mean, they just don't. I mean, Obama has been the master defender, and he certainly hasn't slowed up the expansion of the national security state. He's certainly expanded it. And, you know, the moral rectitude, to say it that way, by which they display all this, all of them, I just find extraordinarily unbecoming what it really means to be an American. And, you know, it's probably fair to say that I have a profound sense of betrayal that I experienced in my own country. But you have to remember, I became an enemy of the state. They were going to do their darndest to make an object lesson of me. And the fortunate thing is I was able to hold them off. But in this day and age, you know, under this administration, it's been an unprecedented war on whistleblowers and information. More people have been charged on the Espionage Act than all other, for non-spy activities, than all other administrations combined. What does that tell you? I have, you know, people I know that have been charged on the Espionage Act are currently in prison. Mm-hmm. Others have faced prison. I remain a free man. I can't even begin to tell you what it means to be free, but I'm a canary in that constitutional coal mine. I don't want, you know, I lived the surveillance state. I had my life turned inside out. I mean, they did everything they could to find everything they could about me over many years.
How does that feel, Tom, to have the machinery that you once operated turned against you?
You know, I have to remember, I flew during the latter years of the Cold War as a cryptolinguist on RC-135s, and my target country, the country in which I became an expert, was East Germany. That was a fascist surveillance state, and it collapsed. And I can only imagine, you know, and they were monstrously efficient in keeping track of their citizens and then some. You can imagine if they had access to the technology of today. I mean, I've said this before, but, you know, they'd be drooling at the prospect. That's precisely what we have in this country. I mean, yet most people just go about their quiet lives, you know, this panopticon, right? It's like, hey, I still can go to the grocery store. I can do all the normal things. That's true. Hey, if the government is surveilling to that level, right, in spite of all these failures you've had since, you know, although they have stopped some plots, I'll be the first to admit that. By virtue of simply having that type of apparatus, you're going to see a lot more things. But I think in many respects the mantra of see something, say something has become our version of what the Stasis used to say. It was to know everything.
Mm-hmm.
To know everything. And it's pathological. You'll never know enough, and you'll always want to know more. And we've turned on our own. We've turned on ourselves. And so when a country turns on itself, that doesn't speak much or well about its own future. And I don't want to find ourselves in a place where we have a digital fence around us, and we're prisoners of our own design in this country. It's not the country that I took an oath to keep, and it's certainly not a future that I wish to keep.
And Tom, this Stasification of the American security apparatus, it gives me pause, too, because I have to believe that this call is being monitored, that all of your calls are, and that even before I spoke to you, that I'm on somebody's list because of all of the interviews that I've done with people who are similarly situated. And I do have this sense of first of all, a kind of freedom, but that it has limits. And yes, no one has knocked on my door, no one has tried to stop me from doing this, but it doesn't mean that they won't.
Yeah, and I've had people knock on my door, and I've been followed, and I was in electronic surveil for years on end, and I had physical limits placed on me during the pendency of my public trial, where I could not leave the immediate area without permission from the court, and the government could say no at any time. I mean, it's a frightening thing. It really is.
And let me ask you about this last line of inquiry, please.
Sure.
I learned from James Bamford that there was this kind of wink and a nod that when intercepts turned up conversations with journalists, that they were supposed to be especially flagged. And the implication was that this was done to protect the special First Amendment rights that journalists have. My suspicion is that darker motives were in play, and this flagging of any intercepts of journalists was intended to zero in on people like Risen and Lichtblau. And we know from the proceedings attempting to bring Risen into court that he certainly was the subject of these intercepts. Can you shed any light on that?
No, that's precisely the case. When you set up the surveillance apparatus in such a way, then it's extraordinarily tempting, in the deepest of secrecy, to target journalists and reporters and those you don't like. And I became aware of a special part of that surveillance system that was simply siphoning off intercepts related to journalism and journalists and reporters and those the government didn't like. It's way too tempting. I mean, this is the seductive means by which you listen in. And if you're in power, it's like, hey, I've got the power. I'm going to keep track. It doesn't matter, because who's going to stop me? It's a catch-22. Who's going to stop me? What are you going to do, haul me into court? Well, then you've seen what happens. We'll just invoke state secrets and executive privilege. And you have no standing because you can't prove that you were actually surveilled.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Wow. It doesn't mean that you weren't. You just can't prove it. So if you can't prove it, then it's as if it doesn't exist, and you have no legal standing by which, or no merits, as it were.
Yeah.
They tried in my own case to eliminate as admissible or relevant any of my whistleblowing activity, as if that history was now expunged. They tried to eliminate as in terms of relevance or admissibility anything related to my First Amendment activities. That was contact with a reporter, which I later did have, okay, after exhausting all their channels of government, and they wanted to eliminate as admissible relevant anything related to classification. How convenient is that? So, yes, I mean, Bamford, who was a defense expert in my case, provided extraordinary support, far beyond anything that's been stated or public, that's been published in the open. That's part of the surveillance system, and... We're one of the most NSA, in partnership as well as other government agencies, has extraordinary access to phenomenal amounts of information. The Utah data center out in Bluffdale. I mean, people have asked, what is that? Well, what do you need it for? Why would you need a place, a dark cloud, as it were, a very secret dark cloud? Why do you need it all? I mean, if your intelligence is good enough, you can take action without having to collect everything. They want to collect everything. It doesn't matter where it comes from. They want to be able to process it all, and anything that's considered private is suspect because that means you're hiding something. And if you're innocent, we just need to prove that you are. So you're assumed guilty, and you've got to prove yourself innocent based on what we say in secret. You have no control over what we say is or isn't. I don't want to live in that kind of country. I really don't. I mean, that's why I continue to speak out as powerfully as I possibly can and come on shows like yourself and others. It's because it doesn't speak well. What kind of country are we ultimately going to inherit going forward with that kind of technology? I've heard all of the arguments. I've heard all the government memes. Hey, if you're doing nothing wrong, you have nothing to worry about.
Right.
And yet I'm a prime example of precisely what happens when the government actually thought. They thought I was the ringleader source for the New York Times article published in December 2005. They actually made me far more than I was. I wasn't. I had nothing at all to do with that article. I never had contact with any reporter from the New York Times. In fact, I had no contact with any reporter until February 2006. Yet they insisted because the absence of evidence meant that I must have been a really good spy. And ironically enough, I haven't said this much publicly, but I'll say it here on your show, the very documents that they allege were classified, that they seized from my house, or they seized a whole lot of stuff, including Risen's book, State of War, right? The documents they seized in whole or in part were actually given to 9/11 congressional investigators and the Department of Defense Inspector General audit of Trailblazer and Thin Thread. I was cooperating with official government investigations and was told to keep what I could that was unclassified, so I did. And that was the basis for the Espionage Act charges, because they thought, oh, you have all this because you kept it on purpose, because you were going to disclose it. Yeah.
Really. Do you think they really thought that, or were they simply constructing the case with the materials available?
They were constructing the case with the materials available. They had to go through the motions to make it look like, right? And the best way to do that was charge me under the Espionage Act. Remember, once you're charged under the Espionage Act, you're painted in the same corner. I've talked to Dan Ellsberg about this. The same corner as the Aldrich Ames and the Hansons and the Alger Hisses of the world. And the irony in my case is I was the fourth person, Ellsberg was the first, charged under that modification of the Espionage Act, the World War I statute from 1917, designed actually to go after spies, not whistleblowers, not truth tellers, not holding up the mirror of the government saying, hey, government, you're doing wrong here, you're committing illegality, you're engaging criminal activity under the law. Well, that was a paragraph added in 1950 under the National Security Act. Pat McCarran, senator from Nevada, was responsible for adding 793E, that E paragraph, to deal with the so-called pumpkin papers caper involving Alger Hiss. That by virtue of having information/documents, you could be charged because your intent would be to give it to someone unauthorized to receive it. That's precisely how they charged me. And, of course, they threw obstruction of justice and making false statements to FBI agents on top of that. I was facing 35 years in prison. You know, at one point during their investigation, their first chief prosecutor actually threatened me. This is April of 2008. How would you like to spend the rest of your life in prison, Mr. Drake, unless you cooperate with our investigation? That's what I live with.
Tom,
I'm an American, and I took an oath to defend. This is what's happened. Standing up and speaking truth to power, has become a criminal activity. That's what they have. They criminalized my calling them out on their own wrongdoing. That's upside down justice. And they did everything they can. Of course, this is what their intent is to break people, blackball them, bankrupt them, to the point where they finally say, uncle. And, you know, John Kiriakou, here's the dubious distinction. I'm the only person that was prosecuted indictment with respect to the secret surveillance program. Never mind all the fraud, waste, and abuse and all that stuff, you know, Trailblazer. The secret, that's the part they really didn't like, and the fact that there was a legal alternative that would have protected U.S. persons' Fourth Amendment rights under the Constitution. That was thin thread. They didn't like that. I'm the only person that was prosecuted and indicted. The people that authored the secret surveillance program, the people that actually broke the law for a minimum of actually 6 years, more actually seven, by the time you get to the FISA Amendments Act. Do you know that it's actually, there's criminal sanctions? 5 years in prison and $10,000 fine for every instance you violate FISA without a warrant? Although there was allowances made for hot pursuit, even under FISA, although you'd come back within a certain period of time to seek the warrant from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. None of those people were ever prosecuted. So then there's John Kiriakou. He's in prison right now in Laredo, Pennsylvania. Why? Because he actually disclosed one of the torturers under the state-sponsored torture program run by the CIA and all those many, many black sites. He's the only one prosecuted and indicted. And he had nothing to do with torture. He never tortured anybody, even all of the things he did at CIA overseas, including the two or three years after 9/11, and he refused the torture training. And by the way, just so you know, that torture training, they used the SEER program that I went through as an air crew member in 1980. That's the survival, evade, resistance, and escape program. I went to that program at Fairchild Air Force Base. That program was the template for the torture program, what they called enhanced interrogation techniques. I was waterboarded twice. I went through all of the stress positions. Everything you hear about, that was part of that program. But that program wasn't designed to teach you how to torture. It was designed to teach you how to resist torture and resist coercion and resist all kinds of other things, including a super highly classified program, which I can't talk about to this day. There was a follow-on to that program, which is all in your head. I never imagined, to my horror, when I started hearing about Abu Ghraib and JAG officers coming to me in private saying, Tom, you have no idea the extent to which this is run out of the highest levels of the government, and we have all these black sites all over the world. And it turns out, in the more recent report, at least 54 countries cooperating with it. The only person prosecuted, indicted, and now in prison for 30 months for that program is the person who called it out. What does that tell you? What does it tell you about our own government? The government has extraordinary power to cover up its own culpability, and if you call them out, they'll criminalize you for calling it out. And those are the two biggest scandals of the Bush administration. So Obama, looked forward, not backwards. He certainly took enough time to look backwards to ensure that those who were holding up the mirror would get prosecuted. Not just prosecuted with just normal, you know, charges. No, prosecuted under the Espionage Act. So no, you asked me. I sometimes don't sleep very well at night. It's been extraordinarily difficult time for me, and yet I'm not going to shut up. I'm not. There's too much at stake. There's too much that's gone down, and much of what I talk about and what I share, I'm out on Twitter. That's sort of in terms of my stream of consciousness, I share that on Twitter, and my Twitter account. I continue to write. I continue to speak powerfully. I've been invited on panels and other fora. I'll be on a panel at the Ridenour. The Ridenour is their 10th anniversary. I was a Ridenour truth-telling prize recipient a couple of years ago, a couple of months when I was still under the gun, until the government's case collapsed under the weight of truth.
You're also featured in a new film that's just been released from Robert Greenwald called War on Whistleblowers.
Yes. I was at the premiere in D.C. yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
They had a premiere in New York City earlier today. It's a war on whistleblowers. I mean, it's a war on truth-telling. It's a war on information. It doesn't speak kindly. I mean, the government is extraordinarily hyper about exposure of its own conduct. And they use secrecy to hide. I mean, it's a violation of even the executive order to use the classification system in secrecy to hide government wrongdoing. It's actually spelled out in the executive order. But that doesn't matter. I mean, whistleblowers have very little protection. I mean, you have a situation now, you talk about hypocrisy. Whistleblower Protection Hansen Act was actually passed in late 2012. Something that had been worked on for upwards of a decade to a dozen years. Unfortunately, all national security-related positions are exempt. So the president, I think, to throw a bone during the run-up to the election for his second term, threw a bone by signing a presidential directive that mandated that each agency have a mechanism by which a whistleblower can come forward, right, internally. But there's the last paragraph, which means, hey, you know, if we decide to fire you, that's essentially what it is, it doesn't matter, you're screwed. And yet, just recently, they're pushing agencies to further exempt even more employees who have no clearances at all by simply designating their position as sensitive for national security reasons. Sensitive. That will encompass hundreds of thousands of additional federal employees. You tell me. Because if they do that, guess what? The Civil Service Reform Act of 1978, the Merit System Protection Board, and all the whistleblower protections are null and void because national security is exempt from all that. Mm-hmm. And that's precisely what we're seeing happen. If it's national security, you're exempt from the law. If it's national security, you get out from under the Constitution. If it's national security, hey, you have no cause of action. You have no means to pursue a suit in court. You're on your own. And by virtue of being a government employee, you've now taken an oath of fealty to the national security state. That's what's happening.
It's the fifth ace in the deck.
Sure is. And the fourth branch of government, which is ostensibly the fourth estate, is supposed to hold, if all else fails and the three branches can't check themselves, particularly Congress and ultimately the judiciary, although obviously there was a third branch of government, my own criminal case, and that was fortunate for me that the judge saw how pernicious the government was in going after me, unconscionable, we don't do this to Americans, you took 2.5 years to indict them. You know, we fought the American Revolution for that reason, right? People just can't show up and say on a whim, hey, you know, you're guilty, that there is due process. I said that on the steps of the court. Here we are. I mean, but even the mainstream media, you know, they're given access and press credentials, and somehow those credentials entitle them to, hey, don't talk about this. I mean, I heard this at the First Amendment Forum in the fall of 2010 at the museum. The government actually admitted that they would give secrets on purpose, actual classified information to reporters just to appease them as a way to ensure, to prostitute them in a way that they would not then report on what was really going on.
Mm-hmm.
We'll give you a little bit of this to satisfy you, to just satiate you enough, but by virtue of that, we're going to tell you what we'll let you publish. That's not the press in this country.
Well, and Tom, what you just described is the dictionary definition of fascism.
Yes, it is.
And I'm not afraid to use the F word. It applies.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say you're not afraid to use the F word, because that's the word. It best describes the form of governance that increasingly the national security state has taken on. And history would say a lot about that now, wouldn't it? You know, I'm a student of history and politics, and we have this weird streak. It's a pathological streak in our own country. I'm more than willing to hold the mirror to who I am as an American. This authoritarian streak, and it seems that in times of national crisis, real or imagined, or unfortunately since 9/11, often manufactured, the faux fear and the hysteria, you know, more recently characterized by cyber hysteria. That authoritarian streak is the excuse, the justification for a whole lot of other activities. And there are those who, you know, curry power. They love to curry it in secret. And hey, if you get to, I'm telling you, it's very seductive. Remember, I was part of the national security apparatus, but it was outward facing. It was to keep track of what was going on in the world. Remember, I listened in on any number of conversations in East Germany. It's a pretty interesting thing, in secret listening in. Well, what happens if you're listening in on your own people? Oh. Because you're afraid? I mean, that's not our form of democracy as a constitutional republic. When the government becomes afraid of its own people? Oh. I mean, I paraphrase Franklin, and he's, you know, give up a little liberty for the sake of safety, you'll have neither.
Well, and fear has become a commodity.
Yes.
That is dispensed as needed. And, you know, it's very hard, particularly when we look at the domestic terrorism investigations and prosecutions, that so many of them are obviously ginned up with the help of a paid FBI informer who is inserted, who becomes a provocateur, who suggests a crime, provides the tools, and then pops the individual or group when they actually start to act on the plot that was created by the entrapper.
Yeah.
And that has not happened only once. There are dozens of cases where that appears to be the pattern.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm part of an amicus brief for the Government Accountability Project. My case then, and one of the attorneys at the Government Accountability Project, Jesselyn Radak, we filed an amicus brief through the representing attorneys who have the legal standing in New York before the court, and there was an appeals hearing back in February. And you may have seen a rather passionate call to action out on Foley Square after the hearing had ended. That was the National Defense Authorization Act, which does not exempt in the Section 1021, it does not exempt Americans from simply being indefinitely detained, and they throw out due process.
Well, I've covered that case in great detail. Yeah. The attorney Carl Mayer has given us great access and insight into the case, and Judge Catherine Forrest is a courageous woman who read the law and the Constitution and appropriately issued that permanent injunction, only to be end-run by the administration within days.
Well, why do you think that they filed for an emergency stay if they weren't already doing it?
Yeah.
Because they'd be held in contempt. And this is part of what's happening, is that the government will secretly reinterpret or secretly engage in activity that's outside of the law, or this extrajudicial, extra-legal mechanisms. They'll cover it with their memos from OLC and other places, but primarily OLC. And then when this comes up, they'll force legislation that makes it legal, or if they're actually held to account, they're just going to hide behind state privilege. Privilege? I mean, privilege overrides law?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, this is the great fear. I mean, this even in terms of our system of government, if you had an overly powerful, but I'm not afraid to lift the gift horse in the mouth. I mean, Cheney himself said he was ticked off enough after the 1970s. He thought that Nixon had been given a raw deal, and if he ever had a chance, he'd restore the imperial presidency. That's precisely what he did in secret when he was given the national security portfolio by President Bush. He restored the imperial presidency in secret.
Mm-hmm.
And 9/11 was the excuse. Yet 9/11 could have been prevented. We didn't have to go down any of these dark side paths. But he flagged it 5 days after 9/11. He said, we're going to go to the dark side. I don't think people fully appreciate it. But other people say, oh, yeah, whatever you need to do to keep us safe, fine. Hayden had this mantra. Practically every time he turned around, whether it's in public or private or before the executive, we need to make Americans feel safe again. Last time I checked, that's not in the Constitution. The responsibility of the government is to make us feel safe. Make us feel safe? Wow.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you for speaking up, and in particular, thank you for your time today. You're quite eloquent, clearly very well informed. You have confronted the beast and wrangled with it. You have your self-respect, even though you don't have your job and you've lost a lot in this process. And I want you to know that you have the respect of a lot of Americans, myself included.
Well, I thank you for that, and I certainly have had a number of Americans who continue to support and align with me together and continue to face the beast, because the future's at stake, and the best way to predict our future is to create it. And I've said that. I mean, some people have given up. They say it's too late, Tom. I said, really, it is. It is. Well, hey, if we don't do anything about it, then it's self-fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a collective responsibility to stand up to what's not right, to stand up to what's wrong. And I do so in partnership with any number of other people across this country and around the world.
Thomas Drake, one of the NSA4, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Tom. That was very powerful, and I learned quite a bit.
Well, I appreciate you having me on the show.
In my book, Tom Drake is a modern American hero, and I respect him a great deal. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.